But no more. I'm going to give you Nat G.
I'm Nat Green. I'm a grateful alcoholic. My sobriety day is January 26, 1987, and my home group is Northeast Fellowship. And you guys heard John, and so that doesn't make it a bad fellowship because he goes there. it's been a fun weekend, and the speakers have all been great, and I've really enjoyed being here. And I always like coming out to this part of the country a lot. You know, and yeah, that poor gal doing the raffle, she didn't know I was blind, you know. And those of you that didn't know, when I turned the lift to get a number, she goes, "Don't look in there." I think she got embarrassed, but she didn't know I was blind. And to see me walk around, I'm most of the way blind, but I can still kind of get around some, and I run into stuff a lot. But I wouldn't think if I saw someone like me, I wouldn't think they were blind. You guys are going to lose a good person that's rotating out, and that's Susan. She did a great job. You know, she stayed in contact all the whole time from when she asked me to speak here. Sometimes I do this a lot, and sometimes they'll call and ask me to speak, and I don't ever hear from them again. And then maybe you might get a letter 2 days before you're supposed to fly across the country and you haven't made a plane reservation yet. So it's nice to have someone that stays in contact and stuff. And Reggie's been a great host. You know, he's done all the right things. He laughs at all the stupid things I say. And it makes you feel good when they do that, you know. And it has just been a good time here. And John told you I finished telling you his story. And I'm just going to leave it up to your imagination. I don't have that much time. And they've been announcing the dance starts at 9:30, and we told Susan, "What makes you think I'm going to be done talking at 9:30? You know? You know, I got control of the podium, and nobody asked my opinion about it, you know? You know, and Jason, he came out here from California with us, and, you know, God's always right on time if we're willing to listen to him. And Jason was talking about he needed to make amends to his father. He lived out of state, and we heard about this for a couple months, and we were talking one day, and I go, "Well, where's your dad live?" And he goes, "In Arkansas." I go, "Oh, really?" I go, "Where at in Arkansas?" And he goes, "Fort Smith." And I go, "Man, this must be a God thing. I'm speaking at a conference there. Me and John are going out there." And you know, it's like God's right on time. He's ready to make this amend, and God presented the opportunity to come back here and do it, and he did that. And that's just how the deal works, you know. It's like, you know, that God presents an opportunity, and I'm sure God presented a lot of opportunities before I got sober, but who was paying attention to that crap, you know? And so in sobriety, it's about paying attention to God's opportunities that he puts in front of us. And it comes through people most of the time. Or in my case, it came through people. You know, we're supposed to share what it was like. I forgot, one of my ex-wives, the seventh ex-wife, said to tell you guys that she's 28 years old. I don't know why she wants me to lie to you guys like that. We got an 18-year-old son, and I'm not going to tell you the rest of the lies she wanted me to tell you. You know, I love her to death, and she's got the disease of alcoholism, and she won't surrender. And she's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, And it hurts a lot to see people you love, you know, go through that. And there's nothing you can do about it. You know, and the kids are really affected by the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, June talked about that today. And you know, our kids have been affected by the disease of alcoholism. My kid, you know, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous all of his life, just about all of his life. But his mother's been in the disease a lot, and it's affected the kids a lot. And there's been a lot of codependent problems because of it. A lot of the kids trying to make everything okay, trying not to let people know how bad his mother really is, and the anger that's built up inside of him a lot, and there's nothing I can do about that, except for be there when he wants to talk. And I've done that over the years, but it's still hard. You know, my daughter, when I found her when I was sober, you know, it really pissed me off how that go. Her mother had been sober a year longer than me. I didn't like that too much. But so my daughter's been raised around Alcoholics Anonymous, and my oldest kid, he's 30 years old. I know I don't look that old, but I have a kid that's 30. And well, his hair is missing. That's from the brain surgeries, and it's not from being that old. But when I was about 6 months sober, my oldest kid, he was 15 then, and wanted to come live with me. And there was a lot of anger from that kid. And the book talks about how long, you know, that sometimes it takes a long time to repair these, the damage done by alcoholism. And my oldest kid, for 14 and a half years, he'd tell me what a worthless piece of crap I was, and he'd cuss me out, and he'd tell me, "You were never there as a father, why try to be now?" And I didn't think that relationship was ever going to heal. And now he calls me about once a month at least, and he tells me, "Pops, I love you." And I didn't think that was ever going to happen. Yeah, I guess I should tell you a little bit about my drinking. You know, I have a dull, boring drinking career, except for those people that listen to my tape know that's a lie. My sponsor says I have a dramatic sober log as I do a drunk log. I've had an exciting life. It's been different. And if you're new and you think, "Well, I'm not as bad as that guy, I could go a little while longer." If you get as bad as me, most people don't. There's medical journals been written about me, how I've lived through it. You usually won't live if you do what I've done. My youngest brother, he always said, you know, if I ever get as bad as Matt, I'll do something about my drinking. And it's using, and he's been in and out of prison a lot, and he's shattered his ankle, he's got a plate in, he's been, you know, his kids have been raised by someone else because he's been in prison. But if he gets as bad as me, he'll do something about his drinking. Yeah, I started drinking at a real young age. I didn't think it was real young, but I started drinking. I mean, I drank, like you heard in some this weekend, you know, when the parents have a party, and you know, the adult gets up and goes to the bathroom, you got 14 kids scrambling for that beer can, you know. And I mean, it's a quick deal, you know, when you got 14 kids, I mean, there weren't 14 kids in my family, but you know, everybody brings their kids, and you try to get to that, because you know there's a couple sips of beer left in that can, and you swig it down real quick with a couple cigarette butts, and but that's the kind of drinking just to be cool, you know. The kind of drinking that qualifies me to be here is my parents got a divorce when I was not quite in the fourth grade. And the deal is all this crap that was going on inside me. I felt abandoned by my parents. I felt unloved. I felt they didn't want me. You know, the book says we're selfish and self-centered. It's the root of all our problems. And you know what? I never, until I did the inventory steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, never in my life did I ever think, well, you know what, I had brothers. See, my parents, this was only going on with me. Nobody else in the world, just my parents were getting a divorce. Not to my brothers, just to me. And I didn't know how to deal with this crap. And I don't know how your mind works, but my mind, when it can't deal with reality and these feelings, it clicks into, my mind doesn't see all the bad stuff going on, it clicks into what I perceive it to be. My mind clicks into my parents drink and they have parties and people drink and it seems like they're having fun. They enjoy life. That's what my mind sees. After I did the inventories in Alcoholics Anonymous, the truth of it was there was fist fights, there was blood, there was divorces, people got arrested. But see, my mind doesn't see that. It says drink alcohol, enjoy life, have a good time. And when I got my mom's Bacardi rum, I knew this would work because I didn't want to feel this way. And I guzzled that Bacardi rum, and I'd like to tell you I became good looking, my muscles bulged out, but that stuff tasted nasty. And you know, I started to puke, and I was in my mom's bedroom, and it dawned on me real quick. I remembered what puke smelled like. And so I couldn't do that, and I held my hands over my nose and my mouth, and it went up and down about 20 times, and it finally said, you got to be willing to go to any lengths, you know. It finally settled down there in the pit of my stomach, and you know what? For the first time ever in my life, what was going on, it was just okay. It wasn't nothing great. It was just okay. And our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says we drank essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. I drank to feel just okay. And I chased that effect for a lot of years to come. I wanted that first time when I finally got it down to just be okay with the madness that was going on. The madness was still there. It didn't shut the madness out. And I didn't know one day at a time that this was going to be a progressive deal that I was going to drink over. Every time a problem came up, that problem was going to be less and less and less and less until I didn't have a choice of when I drank or not. You know, I found out, I was a sissy in school. I was scared of everything, and kids would pick on me, and I found out you could drink before school, and all of a sudden he became the tough guy, and you could whip everybody's butt on the way to class, and he wouldn't mess with you no more. And you know, I got into big shotism early, and you know, being an alcoholic, if one's good, two's better, and more's even better than that. And so if your buddy got a brand new bicycle, I had to have one, but my parents were divorced and they were in the bars, and so I go steal me a bike, but it might not be better than yours, so I went and stole another one, and I started getting in trouble. In the little town I grew up in, it was a little hick town, they rode horses and all that crap, and they did things to try to embarrass you when you were a kid, because everybody came to town on Saturday, you know, we had a 10-cent movie theater there, So they do things like handcuff me this fire hydrant at the edge of town and with a can of paint and expect me to paint that fire hydrant. And there's two kinds of guys born in this world. Painting fire hydrant kind of a guys and non-painting fire hydrant kind of guys. And I was born a non-painting fire hydrant kind of guy. I would rather be humiliated in front of the whole town as to paint that fire hydrant, you know. And then they started having seventh and eighth grade dances, and you can't ask a girl to dance. You're a tough guy now, so you stand on the back and look cool and tough out of fear. But they say no. Or everybody would pick on you because that girl said no. Like that, dummy, you don't even know how to dance. You look like a jackass out there. But you know, after you go to about 3 or 4 weeks of them 7th, 8th grade dances, and you get tired of holding that corner up looking cool, you drink before you go to dance. all of a sudden them girls were lucky to have you there to ask them to dance, you know. You know, and you can't take the beatings from your mom's drunken boyfriends anymore, so you move out the night before you're 13 and you move in with the president of Hell's Angels. And you walk in this house and there's a good-looking blonde with her hand down his pants and you want what they got right away, you know. And I guess I got drunk enough that night, you know, I must have said yes to eating some pills, and I remember the rest of the night, and I was never going to take drugs, you know, all the bad things you heard back in the 60s. And I couldn't make it to work that morning. And, you know, my job at that age, I pulled transmissions out of cars, and they rebuilt them, and I put them back in. And my boss, he drank and got loaded. And he tells Angels, they told me, take this white stuff, you'll be up and make it to work. And in my mind, I thought, I can't take that. But I said, yes. In a couple minutes, I was up and running around, and I made it to work, and you know, those creepers, that's what you used to roll around underneath these cars and take them out, and my boss kicks it and goes, man, you must have took too much of that white stuff. You're not getting anything done. All you're doing is spinning round and round on the creeper. and you got... He goes, you better drink some and slow down. So I must have, you know, I always overshoot the mark, man. Next thing I know, he's kicking the creeper and said, you must have drank too much. You're doing nothing but sleeping now. You guys don't know how blind guy tells time?
It's 8:29.
That's when everyone on my tape. That's like my trademark, you know. And I went home that night, and I drank and drank and drank trying to go to sleep, and I couldn't do it, so I ate some more pills. And that started this madness of taking a lot of stuff that I never wanted to take, and you know, but I could never say no. And but in my mind, I'm never going to shoot up dope, and you know, because that's drug addicts. And on my 16th birthday, there was this good-looking blonde involved in this deal, and she wanted to shoot us some heroin and cocaine. We were drunker than hell on tequila gold. And this blonde, I'm powerless over blondes, you know. And this girl's going to be the mother of my children. And she don't know now this, but... So I did that, and to this day, I still don't know whether I got a piece of ass off of her. Now, by this time, I'm going to juvenile hall systems, and I was scared to go to juvenile hall, you know, and to get locked up, and I did what I normally do. I went in there and just started beating the heck out of people, and they thought I was crazy, and they left me alone, and you know, I got to visit the youth centers and started doing time, and I wanted to turn 18 because I'm a Hell's Angel, and it's not real cool to go to juvenile hall and they call your parents to get you out. I want to turn 18, go to jail like tough guys do, and bail out and be real men, you know. There's something to really shoot forward to, turn 18, go to jail. That was my highlight of my career. And I'm going to be dead before I'm 21, so I got to get this on in a hurry. And I turned 18, and my dream came true. I was doing an armed robbery, and I shot a cop. And, you know, I have some people, you know, I shot a couple cops in my career, and people think I like to shoot cops, and I didn't, it's not really that I like to shoot cops, but whatever gets in the way of me and my drinking has to go. And the lifestyle I lived, it was usually cops that were in the way. But I'm sitting in this jail cell, and I don't know what you do when you get locked up, but when I get locked up, I do inventories. Get to A, and I don't want to do it, but when I'm locked up, I'm doing inventory. What I did wrong. I shouldn't have never robbed. It wasn't I shouldn't have drank and took those other things. It was I shouldn't have robbed that restaurant and shot that cop. I'm thinking, you know, I don't mind shooting cops and doing armed robberies and going to jail for it, But I'd like to start out going to jail, like, for assault and battery or burglary or something, and work up to shooting cops, you know? I get to think I got to slow this down a little bit. And I get to doing this inventory and thinking, what do guys do that I know that don't go to jail like I do, don't get arrested like I do? It's like, well, they get married and have kids, and God, they have a boring life. And I thought, well, if this will slow this down a little bit, I'll do it. So when I got out of jail, I got off those charges. The cops screwed up, and I got off. And when I got out of jail, I checked with all the girls I was engaged to, and one said she was pregnant. And this was back in 1970, and back then, if you got a girl pregnant, you married them. And so, you know, this is a big deal for a guy like me, see, because I don't get married. I don't keep girlfriends. I don't, you know, because if you get married or have a girlfriend more than, you know, 6 or 7 hours, then they get close to you, and they might find out you're scared, and you're full of fear. And so it's easier not to have one around very long. And so this is a big commitment for a guy like me. And that girl either lied to me, or we need to go in the World Guinness Book of Records because that kid didn't pop out for 18 months. And I don't think I need to tell you that really pissed me off, you know. So, you know, that marriage was never to work, and I had indictments for me and for my arrest in California, and you guys did geographics. I never did geographics. When I had an indictment for my arrest, I moved out of state. It's self-preservation, not geographic. And I moved up to Reno, Nevada, and I got there, man, and got all the bright lights and 24 hours gambling, 24 hours drinking, and it was only like $10 to spend all night in the whorehouse. And I thought, man, if a guy like me could have been born and raised in Reno, Nevada, my life would be good. Now I was born in this little hick town where we rode horses, you know. I mean, I need excitement happening and stuff. And I'm in Reno, Nevada, and you know, the first night there, I won $3,800. And the second night I'm there, I'm in jail. And I wondered how they found out I got there so fast. And the thing is I took me there. I didn't change nothing. And so I'm up there for a while, and I got an indictment for me up in Nevada, and the Vietnam War is going on, and I think, you know what, I need to slow this way down, and I need to get off all this crap, and the United States government, they'll take care of me, and I'm going to go join the Army, and I'm going to become a 10-star general, and they don't have them, but I'm going to become the first one, and this is going to be a big deal for a guy like me. And you know, in Bill's story, it says, I have arrived. Well, I took this old leaking Harley Davidson, and I rode it from Reno, Nevada to Fresno, and old recruiter's building, you had to go up these stairs and go inside, and it was a hardwood floor, and I was way too wasted to get off that motorcycle. So I rode up them stairs, into the recruiter's office, shut that baby off. Oil was leaking all over that hardwood floor, and I stood up the best I could, and I said, I'm the one you're looking for. You'd probably tell they weren't too impressed. And I did the same thing like John did. I took all their stupid tests and passed everything, they said, when do you want to go in? And I had these indictments for me, and I said, today would be fine. They said, no, you got to come back tomorrow. And man, you know what kind of fear that is? That knowing you got to go out there in the world one more night before you can be taken care of? And trying to find enough madness to take care of yourself, you know, to just make it through one more night so you can escape. And back then, they were sending everybody from California back to the East Coast for basic training and everything, everybody from the East Coast to the West Coast for basic training. And this is a big deal for a guy like me, you know. And I buy all this stuff for the bus trip back east. and got time to get on the bus, and they said, Matthew Gerald Green. I go, yeah. And they go, you're on this bus over here. And I go, where's that going? They go, Fort Hood, California. It was about a three-hour bus ride. And you know what? I had to take all this stuff and drink all this stuff. I mean, I couldn't just throw it away. And we get to Fort Hood, and you know, I'm on the back seat. And I don't know if you've been on the service, but those drill sergeants like to scream and yell at you. And they were doing that at me. You know, everybody else is off the bus, but I'm a little slow getting up. And I know if they would have let them know it was me arriving, they wouldn't have done that. But you know, I'm laying there in that back seat thing, and this guy is just screaming, you know. And I get to doing a little inventory work. I get to thinking, I'll let him know who I am. And I get to thinking, you know how the buses have that aisle way down the center, right? I think if I can get up and get headed with my head a little bit forward, build up some speed down this highway, and you know, on a bus, you got to hang a quick right and go down the step. I figured I could muster up enough speed, I could one punch that dude and knock him out. And you know, I had a good plan A, and I hit that guy, and he went out like a light. But he, as he was going over, I could see that there was about 2 7-foot gorillas behind him. And plan B kind of sucked at that time. You know? First 10 minutes, I'm in the United States Army. I'm locked up in the stockade. If you hadn't guessed, I was doing another inventory. Saying this was a bad decision to join the Army, you know. And they let me out, and I hit someone else. You know, I was always a victim. All these guys were always falling on my fist, and I'd get locked up for it. And I go back to the stockade, and about 15 trips there, I get to thinking, you know what, I've had enough fun here. Time for me to leave. And I went AWOL, and I didn't have no wheels, and I found this abandoned armored truck. And it was running, but there was nobody in it, so I knew it was abandoned. And I needed a ride home to Fresno, you know. And so I took it, and I wasn't greedy about the bill. When I left it parked on the side of the road, I didn't take any bills less than a $20 bill. And I got $60,000 out of it. And this was 1971, now that was a lot of money, and they took 6 months to catch me, and it was all gone. And what really pissed me off, how that deal last that money, I bought 2 cases of beer. I walked out and put it in my car and made it to the road and got pulled over and arrested. I didn't even get to drink one beer. And those cops said they were keeping for evidence. I asked them, what, in your belly? You know them suckers drank it. So I go to the federal penitentiary, and because of the void time and stuff, the service got me back, and I didn't spend much time there. And the service decided they didn't want me out in the service, and they let me out. And you know, all these fears keep going away one by one by one. You know, the fear of going to prison, the fear of getting locked up anywhere, the fear of, you know, all this crap is just going away one by one. And I'm not even 21 years old yet, and I'm going to die any time. You know, and I want to go out in the blaze of glory. You know, I don't want this being no cheap little dying thing, you know. I want to be riding my Harley down the freeway doing about 100 miles an hour and going to town after town, and all these different officers are in pursuit, and they got every national news covering this and everything, and the cops keep shooting me, and I keep riding, and another one shoots me, and I keep riding, and I got about 100 bullets in me, man. Blood's spurting out everywhere. They got every news channel from all over the world there now, and I finally go end over end, and my motorcycle explodes in flames, and I'm dead, and the whole world knows. That's how I want to die. I'm almost 21. This got to happen pretty quick. You know, I'm just going to jump into my seventh marriage now. And think you missed something? There's just a lot more of the same. You know, a lot of institutions, a lot of jails, a lot of being locked up, and a lot of marriages and a lot of madness. And you know, when I got married the seventh time, I'm 30 years old now, and I wanted to die for a long time. I'd been going to AA for a lot of years off and on. You know, the court sent me there, and you know, life just really sucks, and the suicide attempts have been there, and I screw those up, you know, like slip the heck out of your wrist, and my wrist was scarred up, and wanted to die, and you forgot you did a big dope deal, and they kick in your door because they want their dope, and they call 911 because you ran there bleeding to death, and you shoot up enough alcohol one time, because shooting up the dope looks so good, you shoot up enough alcohol wanting to die, and you forgot some stolen money to move in that. That they come over together and they find you out, you know, and you're all blue and purple, and they call 911, they take the money and they split it, and they save your life one more time. And you know, it's like, what do you got to do to die around this place? You know, you've been shot a lot of times, the cops have shot you, you know, it's like, what do you got to do to die? So I get married to this lady, you know, the one I told you that wanted me to tell you, she was 28 years old. And we get this ranch, and we have the ducks and the pigs and cows and all that crap that goes with it. And this is just going to be till I can die, you know. And she's a beautiful lady, and we have this beautiful little baby boy. And life really, really sucks. And I kick her out, and she won't come back one time. And I think, you know what, I ain't gonna let another wife do this. I grabbed a shotgun, stopped at 7-Eleven, I bought two bottles of champagne. I was drunk and loaded to the max. And I bought two bottles of champagne to celebrate. I was gonna blow her head off. And I went over there and she wasn't home, and I kicked the window in, and her neighbors were there, and they knew I'd been locked up a lot and knew how crazy I was, and it just didn't matter anymore. I'm in there and I'm taking all this dope, and I'm drinking this champagne guzzling and drinking tequila gold, and I can't shut the madness off. Whatever I take anymore, man, any combination doesn't shut the madness off anymore. And the SWAT team comes, and they want me to come out, and I can't go out and shoot another cop again. But I can't go out and surrender. I'm a tough guy, you know. And the madness is just so mad. I just can't take it. And it comes in my head, you know, that my oldest kid that he was 13 at this time, I think, and he told me, Dad, he goes, can't you just die and disappear off the world? He goes, I'm so embarrassed when my friends are over and we see you on TV for crimes you committed or in the newspaper. He goes, can't you die and disappear? I thought, you know what, the world deserves me to treat them like crap because they made me an animal. But my kids would be better off without me in the world. And I stuck that shotgun in my head and I pulled the trigger. And when I came through out of that coma months and months and months later, you know, I was all the way blind then, and I have this plate in my mouth, and if I pop that out now, I still can't talk, and I didn't have that in there then, and they had life support systems from all over the country hooked to me, and all this beeping crap's going on, and they had me strapped down one more time of every part of my body that moved with other restraints, And the doctors would come in on a daily basis and tell me, boy, there's nothing we can do for you. You're going to die. And the people from Alcoholics Anonymous came up again, and they were really insensitive to this situation. I mean, because they would knock on the door and they ask, can we read you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And they'd sit down and start reading me the book like I got a choice in this matter, you know. You know, and the sad thing is every person that came up to read me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they did day after day, month after month, month after month. None of those people are sober today, and that's sad. You know, and the deal is because they quit doing the service. and they quit going to meetings, and they're all out there still, and a couple of them have died. And that's a sad deal. You know, and I look at that, as you can tell, and I get out, and they want me to come by and take me to these stupid AA meetings. I've been going to AA by this time, I'm off and on for 10 years. I know this crap doesn't work. I mean, I've been going for a long time. I had enough 30-day chips, I could start my own fellowship. You know, John's a candy ass. He came to his first meeting and ain't drank since then. You know, I mean, you know, the best thing to do is go out and collect 40, 50, 60, 30-day chips, you know. I mean, just go out there and grind it and try it and try it, you know. Have some more fun. Why come here your first time and say, I quit and have a good life? Screw that. Well, you know, I started going to their meetings, and, you know, see, I'm blind, and I expect you to do it for me. And if you're new and you expect AA to do it for you, they will. But the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous can't happen. You see, and I'm blind. I expected you to pick me up and take me to meetings. And they did. 3 to 5 every day. I expected you to get me my cup of coffee because I'm blind. And they did it. I expected you to do everything for me, and they did it. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous didn't happen. In other words, the next couple of years of going to that meeting means I did the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous only. And they give me their phone numbers, and I tell you how stupid you were for giving a blind guy your phone number. I wad it up and throw it down on the ground. And they say, now let's go to coffee after the meeting. I say, I hurt so bad I can't. I got to go home and lay down. And they say, okay, we'll pick you up for the next meeting. You know, they did the deal, but the miracle didn't happen. You know, and on January 25th, 1987, you know, life really sucked. You know, life being sober without working this program, I wanted to die worse than I ever did drinking. You know, I knew, see, I saved up all my synthetic morphine tablets, and I had 455 of them. And I doubled them down with 2 gallons of vodka because life sucked, A sucked. I can't take it anymore. Being sober without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous being applied on your life on a daily basis, life sucks. So if you're coming to AA and just going to meetings and life sucks, then you ought to do it the way we do it. I went into a coma out of that deal. When I came to, I was really pissed. I thought that would work. Then when I came to out of that coma, what really pissed me off, because I've been going to AA off and on for about a month shy of 12 years, and what really pissed me off was like a Star Trek movie in warp speed. All that crap I heard in AA for 12 years was like in warp speed in my head. Yes, Ponce, what's that? It's like, man, I'm awful tired, man. Why don't you shut up, you know? It came into my head, you know, that get on your knees and pray, boy. And I thought, where'd that come from, you know? And I was really weak, and so I rolled out of bed and got on my knees, and I looked up, and it came in my head, pray, dummy. I thought, well, you don't know how to pray. And it came in my head, do the best you can. And my first prayer was a cussing prayer, and I believed that God, that was okay with God, because that was the best I could do at the time. And I don't cuss when I pray today, but that was the best I could do then. Now, if you wonder what the turning point that got me to really get involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and work the steps and get involved in service, was that I didn't have no shining light or burning bush or nothing. You know, it came to me that you know what, that I don't really believe in God, but if there is a God, that he's not going to let me die, I'm just going to keep missing body parts. And I only have one part of me that's an original shape, and I'd like to keep it that way, you know. You guys have got perverted minds. I didn't say what part. And you know what? It's like if I can't die, I'm going to find a way to do this deal. Life is over. No fun. Boring. But I'm going to get involved in the steps. I'm going to actually call my sponsor. I'm going to go to meetings. I'm going to get involved in every kind of service they I can find out about. And, you know, and the doctors are still telling me I'm going to die on a daily basis. I have to go to the hospital every day. And I figured, you know, maybe I could live 2 years and just do tons of service work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Be Mr. AA. And then I'll die. And they'll probably build a monument. And you guys are thinking a little monument. No, I'm talking a big monument. And I'm going to put on there, here lies Matt Green, died, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, did every kind of service available, known to AA, died unhappy. And they're going to fly in newcomers from all over the world. This is going to be such a big event, they're going to probably build a tent city out there or something, you know. And I was starting to get screwed in AA, doing all the service and starting to sponsor people and doing the steps with my sponsor and asking what these stupid initials are. Like in California, we have H&I, which is the Hospital and Institutions, which is the best committee there is in the world. And if you don't think Jesus, maybe you ought to get more involved in it. And I started becoming a coordinator. And I asked what that GSR crap was, and the next thing I knew there was a briefcase on my front doorstep when I was at a penitentiary saying thanks for being on EGSR. And, you know, I'm running around, I'm going to all these different institutions and doing the general service work and volunteering at central office and going to meetings and sponsoring guys and just doing the deal. And you know what, I'd show up at meetings and they'd start saying, look, Matt has a smile on his face. I'd wipe that sucker off real quick. I'm getting screwed out of this deal. It is no fun. Absolutely none. I'm going to die unhappy, never smile again ever in my life. You know, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous started working in my life because I was one who started reaching my hand out. If I heard you talking off in the background while we were going to the coffee shop after the meeting, I'd go over and say, hey, man, if you don't mind, could you give me another big coffee shop? I didn't expect you to come do it for me anymore. I started asking if you could please get me a cup of coffee. I started, you know, they told me to pick up cigarette butts, and John talked about that. We pick up cigarette butts every day at our fellowship, because that's what we were taught to do when we were newly sober. And, you know, like new people say, well, we want to pick up cigarette butts, and we said, well, you got to get here before 11 o'clock every day, because we're here early to make sure we go pick them up. You see, and what is it that keeps us sober? Is it picking up the cigarette butt? Is it the work in the step? Is it going to a meeting every day? Is it all the guys I sponsor? Is it doing all the service work I've always done and still do? Who knows what it is? So who wants to give any one of them up because I might get drunk? If all of them work, why not just keep doing all of them? And I hear people that quit doing one or two of them, and they get drunk, or if they don't get drunk, they're in whining in the meeting. You feel like you got to go to the cheese factory, give them a whole block of cheese for it, you know? And that's not what I want in my life. You know, I want to try, you know, our book says we have a daily reprieve contended on our spiritual maintenance. And so, like, if this is what the old-timers taught me to do in the beginning, and it worked in the beginning to be okay, what makes me think now that I have almost 16 years that I don't have to do what made me okay in the beginning? And I still do that. You know, it doesn't mean that the things life doesn't go on, I go, Dad, there's been a ton of crap happening. Both my parents died in sobriety. Yeah, everything, when I was new, I wrote down everything I would have to drink over. It started out like my kid getting killed, my parents dying, stuff like that. I mean, every day I just wrote something.
This is the end of side one. Please turn tape over to this point for side two and continue playing. Thank you.
Well, Monday Night Football. and all, my kid didn't die, but the doctors performed the wrong surgery on him, and he almost died. And this was a weed deal. We don't do anything here alone, or I don't. And, you know, because of the guys I sponsored that were living in the hospital with me and taking shifts with me, and it was about a 2.5 month ordeal, but the surgery after surgery and to repair what they screwed up. And I went home to take a shower one night, and the doctors called and said, you better get down here right away. He's not going to make it. And I'm going to go kill me a doctor sober. And there was this idiot attorney I sponsored there, and this ex-convict that did a lot, 16 years in San Quentin, and he's big and tattooed down, and they seen I was nutting up, and, you know, they said, Matt, let's pray, and I screw you and your praying, man, I don't kill me a doctor. Said, Matt, what about AA? Screw that AA crap, don't lay that crap on me, and I tried to push my way through them, and they threw me down on the ground. I said, Matt, let's pray. I said, I am your sponsor. Get off of me. And they weren't real impressed with that either. And you know, I thought, well, I'll make these fools happy. I'll pray with them. They'll get off me. I'll go kill me a doctor. And the power of prayer, you know, I wasn't happy about the situation, but we prayed and they went to the hospital with me. I didn't have to kill me a doctor. You know, weird stuff happens to you. I hadn't had a driver's license in 17 years. And I get this letter from DMV, that's what it's called in California, and I don't know what they call it here, but that's who issues you your driver's license. I'm 2 years sober, and I get this letter that says you're eligible to have your driver's license back. I'm still all the way blind at that time. I think I'll go down to the DMV and humor them today. I took this letter down there and handed it to the guy, and he says, yeah, Mr. Green, you're eligible to have your driver's license back. And I go, you don't understand, I'm blind, I can't see to take the test, the driving test. He goes, you don't understand, you don't have to take the test, all you got to do is sign for it. And I told him, okay, if you hold my hand, I'll sign for it. He held my hand. I signed for it, and I got my driver's license back. And I don't know if I could get it still. I moved, and I didn't put a change of address in. And you know, I had to let it go, because as long as I had that driver's license, man, I owned a car, and I wanted to drive that baby, too. And I did drive it to the fellowship one day, and I didn't kill nobody, and someone took it home for me, and so I didn't want, you know, people go, why don't you go see if you can get it again? If I get a driver's license again, I want to drive. It's just something about me, I got to do it, you know. As long as they don't have a driver's license, I don't want to drive. And we get real bad fog where we live. And you can't see hardly past the hood of your car. And so when I drive then, see. Ain't nobody else can see nothing, so. You know, and I found that daughter in sobriety, and that was a weird guy speaking over on the coast, and the judge when I had to go to court on this bill and do a maternity test. And I said, well, you know, I want visitation rights. And he had my civilian record there, and he said, scumbags like you shouldn't be allowed to ever see their kids. And if you ever try to find out if it's a boy or girl or anything about this family, you'll go back to the penitentiary. Well, that was good enough for me not to ever pursue it. But I get sober, and I hear people talk in meetings, and you know, you get to the men's steps, and man, I owe this kid a men's, and who knows where they are? Don't know whether it's a boy or girl. And it bugged me, man. And you know, you hear this crap, you know, if you're willing, God will present the right time. It's like, screw you, you know, give me a friggin' answer, you know. I was speaking over in San Luis Obispo over on the coast, and we stopped to get gas and Paso Robles, and me and this kid's mother never even lived in this town, and something's bugging me to look in the phone book. And one of my sponsors is with me, and he goes, what's wrong? I go, man, nothing, just get in the car, just get the heck out of this little hick town. And we leave, and we get about 10 miles out, and he goes, something's really wrong with you. And I go, turn this friggin' car around, we're going to look in the phone book. I tell him what's going on. We get back, we pop open the phone book, I go, see, her name isn't in there. She's probably remarried and everything. And we pop it open, and there's her mother's name in the phone book. Oh, man, he said, if I tried to get a hold of him, I'm going back to penitentiary. This was years and years ago. But so I call up, and this little girl answers the phone, 13-year-old girl. And I asked for her mother, you know, and she says she's not there. I go, is she at work? And she goes, yeah. And I go, well, could you have her call me when she gets home? So she gets a pencil and paper, and she goes, okay, what's your name? And I go, God. I go, Matt Green, and I heard this. I go, what does that name mean something to you? And she goes, you're my dead father. And her mother didn't call for 6 hours. And my daughter wanted me to come over right then, and I told her I couldn't. And I went through all this fear for 6 hours. You know, it from that phone call on, it's like I abandoned God. You know, this loving, caring, forgiving God that I found here. I took over control, man. I'm in control of the situation. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to make it happen. And I went in total fear for that 6 hours. And then her mother called, and I'm trying to make amends to her over the phone and tell her, you know, I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober this long, and I'm going on and on and on and on. And she finally goes, Matt, can I tell you something? I go, yeah, but. And she goes, no, listen. And then she told me she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, told me how long she'd been sober, and she'd been sober a year longer than me, and it really pissed me off. And I got my daughter on the phone, and she goes, I don't hate you anymore. You can see your daughter, and I'd like for you to have a relationship with your daughter. And I got my daughter on the phone, and I went over and seen her, and I was scared a lot. And another member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was real involved in the H&I committee offered to drive me over to the coast and see my daughter. And we went over and took her to lunch. And then my daughter have a really killer relationship, and she's a mother of two of my grandchildren. And, you know, my daughter got arrested on Christmas Eve 1 year. She called me from jail, and she knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd been raised to love her life around Alcoholics Anonymous. And she goes, Dad, I didn't call you Christmas Day. And I go, I know, what's up? She goes, I'm in jail. I go, what are you in jail for? And she goes, well, we were eating acid and driving on the freeway, and we were speeding, and we got pulled over, and we had a sheet of acid on the seat, and we got arrested for intent for sales and under the influence and speeding. I go, did you learn anything? And she goes, yeah, don't eat acid and drive on the freeway. Eat acid and stay home. And now if my daughter wanted me to come take her to the recovery home, man, I'd been right there. But eat acid and stay home, it was the wrong answer. And this is my little girl, man, I didn't bail her out of jail. It was really, really hard. You know, shortly after that, she called and said, Dad, I'm pregnant. I go, oh, man, I'm going to have to take care of this kid, this grandbaby. And, you know, I don't know why, but that was a turning point for her. I don't understand that. Get pregnant, quit drinking, quit getting loaded. What a stupid idea to quit for, you know. But my daughter, that was a turning point for her. And she's a great mother, and you know, I have a flaming, red-headed 6-year-old granddaughter that, boy, she goes, I call her my flaming, red-headed dude, and she goes, Papa, I'm not a dude. And she likes me to carry her all the time, and I've had the back surgeries and everything, and I know it's going to tear me up, but I carry her anyways. And she'll go, Papa, and point at something, and I go, you don't have to say nothing else, honey, you can have it, you know. And and I got my grandson, he'll be 2 years old in February, and I got plans for that guy. I mean, we're going girl watching here for a couple more years. And he's going to point out the blondes for Grandpa so I can marry him, you know. And you know, when my dad died, you know, because I've been involved heavily and still am in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Program of Action and Service, and whether I like it or not, I keep my commitments and do the deal, like it or not. That's what I was taught here. And when my dad died, he wanted to die at home, and there were things that had to be done to my dad so he could die at home. And I didn't like doing these things. I stayed at my dad's house so my dad could die at home. And my brothers and sisters, so they couldn't see my dad that way. And they didn't know how I did it. But see, I'm the only one who has a Program of Action and Service to do it, like it or not. And, you know, I got to be there when my dad died, and I didn't like going through that, but you know what I call a spiritual experience? Because when I made my amends to my dad, I started calling him Shiny, and we had a really killer relationship, and we spent a lot of time, a lot of years together. And when he was dying, I could tell he was taking a gasp of air, and he hadn't opened his eyes in a couple of days, and I ran up into the bed, and I go, Dad, when you get up there, tell him I call you Shiny, okay? And he opened his eyes and shook his head yes and closed his eyes and died. You know, my brothers and sisters missed that. You know, because of this Program of Action and Service, you do it whether you like it or not. And whether it's convenient or not, you do it. I got to experience that, and I'm grateful for that. And, you know, my mother, I was over in Arizona speaking over there when they took her to the hospital. I didn't make it back in time. But, you know, for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I bitched because I supported my mom in the last 10 years of her life and gave her a place to live. And she didn't drink, but she didn't work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She only went to meeting every great once in a while. And she was a bitter, angry, hateful old lady. And the grandkids would say, why is Grandma so bitter and angry? Why does she scream at so much? And I wanted to tell them because she doesn't work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when my mom died, I'm truly grateful that I was one of the only kid that supported my mom, and that God gave me the privilege to take care of her. You know, and it's like, you know, I try to look at these things, that God's given me the privilege to do it, like it or not. See, that's what you people have taught me. Like it or not, I do it. You know, I've gotten to fly all over the country because of Alcoholics Anonymous and do a lot of things, and, you know, I mean, I got my contractor's license back in sobriety. They didn't want to give it to me because of my felony convictions and being blind. And my sponsor said, well, if you want to do this, see it to the very end, don't quit in between. And I wanted to quit because it was a hassle. And my last appeal, I got my contractor's license back. And I don't want to do it anymore. But at the time, I think that's what God really wanted me to do, because it worked out, and you know, I had some employees, and I made a lot of money, and you know, I was never going to be able to buy a house, and you know, just doing all this 12-step work and service commitments, it sucks, and the young people are running off to the coast, going to young people's dances, and I got these friggin' commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I got to work and be responsible and raise this little kid, you know, and diapers and drag him to meetings. And, you know, life really sucks, man, but I got to do the deal. You know, because I did the deal, all those people I got that were sober at the same time as me that were running off the young people's dances and not doing the deal, they're not here anymore. You know, and I finally got to buy a house, and I have a pretty nice house today, You know, I got custody of that little boy in sobriety. And, you know, these things aren't supposed to happen for a scumbag like me. And you know, I don't do it anymore, but I built a newcomer condo out back. It was a shed that was just sheetrock, no electricity, no heat, no cooling. And we 12-step guys and pick them up. And instead of taking them to the recovery home, I brought them home. And I used to have a lot of guys live at my house. And this newcomer condo, people, when they come over and they heard my tape, they want to see... And so when they come over to out of state and stuff, they want to see the newcomer condo. And it's still there, but I keep the lawnmower in there now. And the lock, we had the lock on, the padlock on the outside of the door, and we just opened it up at 6 o'clock in the morning to let them out. And you know, and we unlock and we sit at the kitchen table, and they sit in that newcomer condo having to take a leak really bad, but knowing they had to pass by the kitchen table to get to the bathroom, and they better muster up a smile because otherwise they're going to have to sit down and talk about it. And so I've had a lot of fun years of sobriety, and you know, like I say, life's happened, and I thought this really sucks. I'm doing all the service, I'm running all over the freaking United States doing this kind of deal, going to prisons everywhere, and when's it my turn to get married? And I met her Al-Anon, and we got married, and it was a really great marriage. I didn't know marriage could be like that. And things happened along the way, you know, and for the first 3 years of our marriage and the year we lived together was just the most awesome thing I ever knew in my life. And somewhere along the line that we did the marriage counseling, we did all this stuff, we went all over the country doing things together and having businesses together, and I just thought we were going to walk down this happy road of destiny as Mr. A and Al-Anon. And things changed. And I'm going through a nasty divorce right now, and I'd like to stand up here and tell you that, you know, that don't happen to me. But it's happening, and people go, God, you seem to be getting through it really good. And I do. You know, the thing is I stay plugged in every day. Our book says we have a daily reprieve, not a weekly reprieve, a daily reprieve. I have to get up tomorrow morning and do it just as much as you do, newcomer, tomorrow. Probably even more than you do because you don't know any better yet. And you know, so it's like being plugged in, doing what I do on a daily basis, all the phone calls I make, all the people that call me, the sponsor and all the guys I do, they're going to the meetings every day buying donuts for those eight bums. Me and John buy donuts for those eight bums every day. And we pick up the cigarette butts and we do the deal every day. And when a problem comes up, I immediately am in the solution because I'm in the solution all the time. It doesn't mean that I don't get pissed off or things don't go wrong. They do. But I have a solution to my problem. Now, if I only have a daily reprieve and I haven't been to a meeting for a week, I'm 7 days from that reprieve. So when this problem comes up, I have a problem, and I'm screwed. I either got to go back whining to you in a meeting or go get drunk. And I'd much rather have a problem come up in my life, and I go to the meeting and tell you this is what came up and this is the solution I have, or I'd call my sponsor, or me and the guys I sponsor, or I was in another meeting, this is what I heard that helped me get to see that this is the God's big picture of the plan. You know, and John talked about the plan, and there is a plan here. But if we have this daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual maintenance, it's God's plan, not ours. You know, about several months ago, I did a job. The guy called and he says, this is Sergeant so-and-so from the Coast Police Department. Well, I was going to hang up the phone. Like, they don't know where you live if they got their phone number, you know. And I thought, you haven't done nothing wrong. And he wants me to come over and do this job. And I go over and I get there, and here he is. He's got his cop car in the driveway. He's decked out in his uniform. He stands in the driveway waiting for me. It's like, man, this was a setup. I thought, well, go up there. I walk up, I hold my hand out and go, hi, I'm Matt Green. He goes, yeah, I know who you are. Oh, crap. He goes, I used to arrest you. I was the first SWAT sergeant on the scene when you shot yourself. I've heard nothing but good stuff about you for the last 15 years. And I gave him a price on the job, and I went home, and he called back and asked, could I come back over? He wanted to add a little bit more, and it's just a one-day job. And I went over and gave him the price, and he goes, okay, you got it. When can you start? And I said, well, we can't finish the job we're doing right now, waiting on inspection, so we can come do it tomorrow. He goes, well, I won't be here. He goes, oh, that's all right. And he reaches in his pocket, pulls out these keys, and he peels his house key off, and he goes to hand me this house key. I'm looking behind me. I know this is a setup. And I finally take the house key, you know, and I don't like it. I mean, I didn't sleep very good at all that night. And we go over and we do the job the next day, and we're cleaning up, and he gets there, and he's also in charge of the rifle range, and so he's in his driveway, and him and me are talking. My guys are cleaning up, and he's got the trunk over, and he's got all these kind of, every kind of gun you can think of. He's pulling out, check this one out, and they're loaded, and he's handing them to me and stuff, you know. And I don't like this, but okay, you know. And he puts them all back up, and I said, well, man, I got to get to the bank and cash this check so I can pay the guys. And he just reaches over and grabs me, puts his arms around me, and I hug him, and he hugs me. He tells me he loves me. It's a great pleasure to know me. It ain't supposed to happen for a guy like me. Just because of people like you and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and loving, caring, forgiving God, that happens for a guy like me. It can happen for you too. God bless you, and I love you.